This is Spectrum.
Alternative myth, homeopathy, secret society, hypnosis, the paranormal, alternative energy, UFO abduction, the weird, the wild, and the wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan, here with my co-host, Tom Theophanis, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm good. How you doing?
Doing great. Been an amazing week. In the news today, the White House denies a UFO cover-up. Two petitions totaling more than 17,000 signatures requested the government to disclose any and all documents pertaining to extraterrestrial contact with humans. On Friday, November 4th, a member of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy denied a government cover-up of evidence of contact with aliens. The statement reads, "The U.S. government has no evidence that any life exists outside our planet, or that any extraterrestrial presence has contacted or engaged any member of the human race." Obviously, they haven't been paying attention. The response goes on to direct petitioners towards several projects aimed at uncovering evidence of extraterrestrial life, including the Mars Science Laboratory, the SETI Institute, and the Kepler spacecraft, but states that the government has no credible evidence of extraterrestrial presence here on Earth. We have with us Stephen Bassett to respond to the response of the White House. Welcome, Stephen.
Nice to be with you, Scott.
Oh, nice to talk to you. So, what do you think about the response that the White House has given to the signatures?
Well, as background for your listeners, this particular advocacy maneuver by PRG, Paradigm Research Group, is going extremely well. I'm very pleased. Paradigm Research Group, put a disclosure petition up on the We the People petition section of the White House, which was launched on September the 22nd. By the White House, by the administration. It was up one of the very first submitted. And under the rules of We the People, you have to get 150 signatures before they publish it. And then if you get 5,000 signatures within 30 days, you will get a response, which we did. We had 5,000 signatures in 4 days.
Okay.
And so we were waiting for the response, which finally came on November the 4th in the afternoon, Friday. I should mention that this initiative by the White House has got some merit. It may be a political maneuver as the campaign get going, but they received over 14,000 petitions in the first 40 days. Only about 350 garnished the 150 votes. But it shows that people really do want to speak to the government. They want to say the issues that are important to them. And so I hope that this will continue and move forward. However, the moment I learned of this, I realized what the opportunity was. We got the petition up, of course, and now we got the response. Now, the response is a boilerplate, short statement, which is completely out of touch with reality and utterly indefensible, which is perfect. And if the listeners want to get into it quickly, they can go to the information site for this petition, which is at disclosurepetition.info. And at disclosurepetition.info, you can see the link right to the response, or you can go to the whitehouse.gov website and you can go to We the People and you can find the response. The petition itself has been pulled down, though they have a copy of it there. And at the disclosurepetition.info, you can see the media coverage is being logged in. I expect to have over 200 articles logged in by the weekend. So you can see the media coverage in the English language press around the world. We are getting reports that the petition and the response is being covered in other countries, in other languages, substantially. So we've got a significant ball in play here. Now, the whole point of this from the beginning was to get that response. Why? Why is that so important?
Yeah, you would think you'd want them to come out and say, "Okay, you got us. We've been covering this up for since 47.
Yeah, well, I mean, they could have done that, but I didn't expect it. But what they did do was, this is the first time in the entire history of this issue, certainly going back to when the issue exploded, the phenomenon exploded into the public's mindset in the early 1947, that the executive branch of the U.S. government has issued a formal statement about a formal position on it, which is us a stationary target. What they've used before is moving targets, not really taking position, always dancing around it, dealing with the requests that were coming in by putting out form letters from the Air Force saying we don't go to investigate UFOs, but avoiding at all costs a situation where they could be confronted by the press with clear information and evidence that contradicts their formal written position, because they didn't have a written position. Now they do. And this position is completely indefensible. So if you were to view the disclosure advocacy movement as a type of chess game being played with government, then it's very possible that they have made a fatal move here by issuing this response, because now we can focus our efforts directly at that response and recruit the media to help us. Because what this has done is given every editor in the country a hook, a legitimate mainstream hook upon which to hang stories if a reporter wants to engage it. Of course, yeah, go ahead. You want to write about that or problems with that position? You want to look at some of the evidence? Sure, why not? It's a formal position by the government. So it may be that this is now the last move, in a way, that from here on we might be able to end this truth embargo in short order. And if the media get involved, if the media decide that they're going to really engage this story at the level it needs and deserves, they've been covering it, and there's a lot of articles, no question about it, but not to the level that it's appropriate, right? And most people know what appropriate is. The more profound the issue, the more significant impact it may have on the society and the citizens, the more depth we expect from the media. So if the media did just light cursory coverage of the Iraq war, people would be up in arms. All right? And of course, that's not the case. So there you have it. We'll continue to use this petition process. I expect to have another one up in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I was going to ask that if you're going to. Are you going to reword it? What are you thinking of?
Well, I haven't decided yet, but it will be a disclosure type position. It will be relevant.
Okay.
And come at the issue from a different angle, making what amounts to a different request, but it'll be pretty clear, the connection. And then I'll pre-promote that for a week or two, get as much advanced awareness as possible, and then we'll set it up, and then we're going to have to go to town, because we're going to have to get 25,000 signatures to get a second response from the White House. But that's fine.
I don't think that's going to be a problem. Where do people go to sign this petition?
Well, the petition, the disclosure petition that has been up is now done. It's been responded to and pulled. And the other one as well. There was a similar petition that was up, and that's also been pulled. But the petition initiative that the White House is running is at the whitehouse.gov website. They have a section called We the People. The link is right at the top of the White House page. When you go in, you can see the petitions. You can see the responses. You don't have to register to do that. But if you want to sign any of these petitions, you have to register with the We the People section. You have to provide the email. They send you a password, and then you go back and sign in, log in. So that's going to be in play indefinitely. But you can follow the disclosure petition, the response, the next petition. All that's going to be logged in at disclosurepetition.info.
Okay, so they can sign up with you to get updates.
No, they sign. Well, they can always sign up with Paradigm Research Group to get updates. Just go to paradigmresearchgroup.org and go to the subscribe link. But they can check in to that website whenever they want and see what's going on with respect to this whole petition process.
Yeah, I think that would be important for people to sign up to the site itself, to your site itself, because that way when you're going to be putting the next petition out, you can send it out to everybody and say, okay, guys, you know, come sign the petition.
Of course. We're using every means possible to spread the word about this. And, of course, we'll try to do as much or more when the next petition goes up. But right now we want to use what we have here and go and do as much as we can.
All right. Okay. Well, I think everybody should go to the site and subscribe at your site so they can get the update when you're making the next petition so everybody can run in and sign that. I don't think you're going to have difficulty getting 25,000 signatures. I really don't. This is an issue that has been around for a long time, and there is a lot more people aware of it now than there was in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Sure. And something I should mention, the way they structured this, anybody in the world can sign. It's not limited to U.S. citizens. Any country, any person can sign if they got an email address. So everybody can participate, and we certainly welcome signatures from outside of the country because obviously this issue has global implications.
I completely agree. Okay, well, thanks. I was looking forward to what you had to say on the subject, and we'll keep at it, and eventually we're going to get the truth, hopefully.
Oh, Scott, let's do an interview in the near future as things develop.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Well, that was interesting, wasn't it, Tom?
Sure was. It's nice to hear from Stephen Bassett again, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, tonight's guest is Mac Maloney, who is the author of over 40 books, including two bestsellers. He was born in Boston, Massachusetts. He went through high school there and then graduated from Suffolk University in Boston with a degree in journalism. He went on a graduate school at Emerson College, earning a degree in filmmaking. He then worked at corporate public relations for the General Electric Company before leaping to write full-time. The vast majority of Mac's work has been in military fiction. However, because several of his highly popular novels dealt with military and UFOs, when he approached his editor about writing a nonfiction book on the topic, he got the immediate go-ahead. Mac gathered a mountain of information from many sources and spoke with some highly acclaimed UFO researchers, including Jerry Clark, Keith Chester, Richard Hines, and Stan Gordon. He also spoke to a number of contacts in the U.S. military and people connected to the U.S. intelligence services. It took about 2 years to distill all this information down to a collection of about 70 episodes, detailing military encounters with UFOs from 1909 up to the first Gulf War. That's what makes UFOs in wartime what they didn't want you to know. Let's welcome Mac Maloney. Hi, Mac.
Hello, welcome Mac. Hello, Mac, and welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad to have you. Talking about your book, UFOs in Wartime. Now, this is going to be exciting. And you've gone back quite a ways, 1909, and I even have a quote from the book from 1235, where the answer, the scientific answer back in 1235 was, "It's only the wind making the stars sway." I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah, that's a great quote. I got that out of one of Jacques Vallée's books, and I just thought that was an interesting way to kind of get into the story. And there's just like a nice ring to that quote. And then later on, actually about a half century before that quote was given. Well, the story behind that was that there was a Japanese general back in 1235, as you said, that started seeing mysterious lights in the sky. So he asked his scientists what they were about, and the scientist came back to him and said, "The whole thing is completely natural. It's only the wind making the stars sway." That quote so much, I had to put it in. But interestingly enough, there was another document that Vallée had mentioned that said about a half century before that people in Japan had described odd things they saw in the sky as flying earthenware, and in other words, flying saucer. So the term flying saucer was actually older than we originally thought.
Wow. Okay, I think I'd like to start out by asking you, how did you originally get involved with the subject of UFOs? Because as Tom was saying, you originally wrote a lot of books on military books. And military stories. So what got you interested, or were you always interested in UFOs?
I've always been interested in UFOs. When I was when I was a kid, I would go to our local library, and I took out and read every UFO book that was available. The Kehoe books were actually the only ones that I was able to read at that time. There wasn't as many UFO books back then as there are now. But anything that I could get my hands on, I would read it, and I love science fiction. And in my mind, the two of them are connected. Then later on, when I was given the opportunity to write full-time, I started out writing military fiction. I wrote a series called Wingman, which was started back in the 80s, and about a fighter pilot who has kind of Zen capabilities, and that was very successful right from the start, and that's what gave me the opportunity, as I said, to write full-time. And as that series went along and was 17 books, as that series went along, I was able to bring in different elements, and in a couple of them, you know, we do deal with UFOs. From there, I was able to write a book called War Heaven, which is about a super-secret training ground in the middle of Nevada where troops would train against each other using holographic weapons, and things go wrong within War Heaven, and it turns out that there's a UFO element to what's gone wrong. So I was kind of bringing in the idea of UFOs into some of my military fiction, and I was just having lunch with my editor one day, and I said, you know, I've been reading a lot lately about different UFOs stories and going back into history and so on, and it just seems like they show up a lot during wartime, and I would like to kind of look into that. And he said, sure, let's do it, and that's really how the whole idea of the book started.
Okay, I've read the book, and it's loaded with a lot of stories, and I've been researching UFOs for a long time, and I was reading some of the stories going, wow, that's really cool. Never heard of that before. So you've dug into it and got some really old stories about UFOs, which is interesting. And I guess the first one I'd like to talk about is that caught my eye was the Red Baron story.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was one of the first ones I came upon, too. And I just thought that was fascinating. Here you have Manfred van Richthofen, who is also known as the Red Baron. He was the top fighter ace for Germany in World War I. He shot down more than 80 planes in a short amount of time. And he was a hero on the German side, but when he was finally shot down, the British gave him a hero's funeral. So he was an interesting character, and one day in 1917, in the spring of 17, he was flying on a combat patrol mission with a his wingman, whose name was Peter Weiser, and they came upon this silver disc coming out of the blue at them. They had never seen anything like this before. The Red Baron shot at it and shot it down. It crashed in the woods. They saw two figures escaping from it. They landed back at their base and told their intelligence officers what they had done. And the higher-ups told them never to mention it again. And Warzarek never did. The Red Baron was dead within a year. Warzarek kept the secrets to himself until 1948 or so, when the stories of flying saucers started popping up in newspapers worldwide, and he realized, you know, that's kind of what we saw that day. So he realized that that there was probably something more to it than they had originally thought. They originally thought it was some kind of a American reconnaissance aircraft, because America had just come into the war. But his what he said was that besides his wife and his grandkids, he had never told anyone the story until he gave the story to a newspaper, a British newspaper, right before, I think he was probably in his 80s and 90s at that point. So it was a fascinating story. It was one of the, like I say, it was one of the first stories I came across. And when my editor saw it, he says, you know, you have to include that, and not only include it, but it's actually, when you open up the cover of any book, especially paperbacks, the first page is what they call front sales, and that's kind of like the teaser, and that's the teaser story for the whole book, the story about how the Red Baron shot down a UFO.
Yeah, that was brilliant. Tom?
Going back, since this book is from 1909, give us the beginning. How did this start? What type of stories started it all out?
Well, we wanted to concentrate on the 20th century because it does seem like there are lots of instances where UFOs show up during wartime in the 20th century. The 20th century being because that's when aerial warfare really first came into being. But I did go back further just to kind of give people a taste of other stories that happened before the 21st century. There's a number of instances where people reported seeing battles in the sky. This is during the Middle Ages. There were woodcuts done of these things. There were newspaper accounts written of them. There was one instance where an entire city in Germany were woken up one day and saw a battle in the sky. And there are a lot of written documents recording that. There were instances where there's even evidence that Christopher Columbus, right before he discovered America, what became known as America, was actually following a light in the sky. There's written accounts that George Washington at Valley Forge, at the really the darkest moments of the American Revolution, back in 1777, consulted with a Indian tribe that lived in something that was described as a flying saucer, and would in this place where they lived, you know, would appear and disappear. Sometimes it would be there, wouldn't be there. So these are things that have happened all through history. And as we were talking about off air, there is instances in the Bible, of course. One of the most interesting stories has to do with Constantine the First. He was somebody who was about to engage in a battle, and the prize of the battle would be control of Rome. He would be the Roman emperor if he won this battle, yet he was considered to be the underdog. His army was smaller than his opponent, and the night before the battle, he saw in the sky what we would call a UFO. It was shaped like a cross. His seers that were traveling with his army told him that this was a sign from above, that he would win the battle if he had his soldiers paint crosses on their shields. And he did this. He won the battle the next day against overwhelming odds. He became the Emperor of Rome. And because of this vision, he made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire. And in a strange way, the Roman Empire became Christian because of a UFO. There's lots of stories like this throughout history.
Yeah, there's lots of stories going back in antiquity, some ancient writings as well. I mean, it's all through the Rig Veda, the Mahabharata, the Upanishads is loaded with stories, the Popol Vuh, you know, it goes back through history. But I'm glad you're focusing on the war, because I mean, unless you wanted your book to be 8,000 pages long, you had to focus on a certain time period. Uh-huh. You have a story in there about the first man to shoot at a UFO, Sub-Lieutenant J.E. Morgan. Could you tell us about that?
Well, this is an interesting story because back when World War One started, World War One was obviously the first war that had an aerial element to it, because there were biplanes, fighter planes, there were some bombers, and there also were the Zeppelins, German Zeppelins, which were military blimps. And earlier in the war, in 1915 or so, the Germans would bomb London and parts of England from Zeppelins, and the British had not yet perfected how to shoot Zeppelins down. Later on, they would find out that the best way to do it was they created incendiary rounds for their machine guns on their planes, and you know, to start a fire on a Zeppelin is basically to shoot it down. But this one night in early in the war, this sub-lieutenant Morgan, J.E. Morgan, was in an unarmed fighter, and he was his role was to fly above London as a kind of early warning system, a crude early warning system, to be on the lookout for Zeppelins. And he was up there, and he came upon this object that didn't look like a Zeppelin. In fact, he described it as as almost like a railway car. He saw a line of windows on it. It was not the shape of a Zeppelin, but it was long and tubular. And the only weapon he had with him at the time was his pistol. So he started shooting at this thing. And after a few shots, it just took off and left the area at tremendous speed. But he is considered to be the first person ever to shoot at a UFO while in flight.
He did that with his hand pistol.
Right. The reason they brought hand pistols with them is that, and it's kind of a gruesome reason, but if they were shot down, there were no parachutes back then. And a lot of these pilots, instead of taking that long plunge down and maybe burning to death, they would commit suicide. And that's why a lot of them carried a small pistol with them, and that's why he had the pistol with him that night.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Tell us a little bit about the Ghost Flyers.
Well, the Ghost Flyers are actually, they are, of all the stories in the book, and the book is basically a collection of stories having to do with military encounters with UFOs throughout the 20th century mostly. But the story of the Ghost Flyers, to me, is the most fascinating, also the most baffling of all these episodes in the book. Quickly, what happened was around the end of 1933, in a very isolated part of northern Sweden, people started seeing these very unusual airplanes flying overhead. And when I say unusual, they were described as having 8 engines, pontoons, a very large fuselage, large wings, large tail sections, and engines that made a lot of noise, and also large searchlights hanging from below the fuselage. And they would see these things at night. They would be flying through the river valleys of this very isolated section of Sweden called Västerbotten. And they, one night, they just showed up one night. One of them showed up one night and was seen by a few people. The next night, more people saw it, heard it. The next night, even more, until when 1933 went over to 1934, in January of 1934, suddenly people in this part of Sweden were seeing these things every night, and not just one. They were reported on simultaneously. There were people who saw 3 or more flying in formation. They would do these crazy things, like, for instance, they had this tendency to circle towns. And for hours and hours on end, sometimes they would be circling and they would shut their engines off. Now, if you can imagine an airplane, first of all, there's very few airplanes, if any, that have 8 engines. And certainly in 1934, there were no airplanes that had 8 engines. But an 8-engine airplane to shut down all its engines and then start them up again, it's almost technically impossible. Yet people would hear these planes doing that. They would circle these small towns or railway stations or mountains for hours, and they would be shining these searchlights down so people could just look up and see these things. And yet, when you think about it, again, from a technical point of view, how could these airplanes do this? Because fuel capacity back then was, they weren't very fuel efficient. Even these days, you couldn't really circle a town or a city or anything for 4 or 5 hours, you'd run out of fuel. Yet these things were doing it. And as I said, they had searchlights, always with the searchlights on, always making a lot of noise. The Swedish Air Force would go up every night and try to find these things. They never found them. In fact, 6 Swedish Air Force planes crashed during the search for these things. No one ever figured out what they were. A lot of people had theories that they were actually German aircraft that were being launched from a German aircraft carrier hidden somewhere in the Arctic Sea. But that explanation doesn't wash because, number one, the Germans never had a working aircraft carrier. Number two, even today, if you had a U.S. supercarrier up in this part of the world, you would be hard-pressed to launch dozens of airplanes off it every night, night after night, fly them, recover them, do it again the next night. It's very hard to launch an airplane off an aircraft carrier, never mind doing it at night under Arctic conditions. Plus, with this German theory, at some point, if there was some secret German battle cruiser that was able to launch these airplanes, dozens of them, which is impossible, really, that ship at some point would have to come home, be resupplied. And that means there would be a break in the action of these ghost flyers being spotted. There was no break in the action. Plus, after the war, no one ever came forward to say, I was on the ship that launched the ghost flyers. No one ever came forward and said, I was one of the ghost flyer pilots. There was never any evidence found of what would have been this enormous kind of aerial undertaking. Then they just went away, and no one ever figured out who they were, what they were, what they were doing. It's just a really baffling case.
Yeah, that does sound like a wild one. Well, from there, you also have the famous story, and I think a lot of people know this, and a lot more people know this since the movie came out, and that's the L.A. UFO.
Right. The L.A. UFO story is interesting, and it's interesting that you brought up the movie because the movie was a comedy called 1942 with John Belushi, and it was directed by Steven Spielberg, and it was almost like kind of a Animal House type movie.
Yeah, I remember.
And which is kind of unusual because what really happened that night is anything but a comedy. It's just funny that so many people, I mean, you know, we know about it, but I don't think that the average Joe knows about it. Basically what happened was February 25th, 1942. Now this is it's actually about 2 months after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. The city of L.A. was, the officials in the city of Los Angeles told that there was going to be an air raid on Los Angeles that night. And they were told to black out the city. There were a lot of defense plants in and around Los Angeles that were valuable to the war effort. A lot of these defense plants had anti-aircraft weapons around them. The day before, an oil refinery had been shelled by a Japanese submarine about 90 miles up the coast from Los Angeles. So Los Angeles was definitely on edge. And then sure enough, that night, actually it was about 1 or 2 in the morning, radar picks up a large number of objects heading for Los Angeles. After they figured that after the air raid sirens sounded, there were 2 million people living in Los Angeles at the time. At least 1 million people were woken up by this and saw these objects over Los Angeles. Of course, at the time, everyone assumes that they're Japanese. And the anti-aircraft batteries opened up on them. There was this wild battle for about an hour. You know, everything with anti-aircraft fire is what goes up must come down. And a lot of the shrapnel and things came down. There were 6 people who were killed on the ground from falling pieces of artillery. It was just mayhem. It was just total confusion for an hour and a half in L.A. that night. And there's a famous photo, which we have in the book, that's owned by the Los Angeles Times, of this object caught in about 6 or 7 searchlights and these anti-aircraft batteries firing away at it. And Bruce McAbee, who was a famous UFO researcher, figures out that this object could be as big as 300 feet across. Then everything went away, and once again, the skies cleared, the air raid was over. People just assumed that these were Japanese aircraft attacking Los Angeles. But immediately, the Army and the Navy went into cover-up mode. And later on, when the war was over, they asked the officers of the Japanese Air Force did you have anything to do with this? And they said, absolutely not. They had no capability to fly planes over Los Angeles in 1942 or at any point in the war. So it's a very strange story that people don't pay that much attention to it, especially since so many people saw them over Los Angeles, and we have this famous photograph. And I think the fact that a movie was made and that it was a comedy, if they ever made a movie, a serious movie about what happened that night, I think it would blow a lot of people away.
Yeah, and I mean, the Hollywood movie Battle of L.A., they took certain liberties with the story and made it something that it wasn't. And I think in the Hollywood version, all they were doing was referencing L.A., and then the rest was just stuff they made up out of their head.
Yes.
So, you know, it was a catchy title. That's what they were going for, I guess. Okay, I'm going to ask you about your book. UFOs in Wartime, What They Didn't Want You to Know. When is that available? And just so everybody knows, I do have a link in the upcoming guest section tonight, and tomorrow you'll be able to see it in the archive shows or past guests area. There'll be a link directly where you can get the book, and I believe you can order the hardcover, or you can get an e-book version as well. So when is that going to become available, or is it available now?
No, it's being published on December 6th. It can be ordered now on Amazon, you know, both in the printed version and, as you say, in the Kindle version. But it'll be in the bookstores December 6th.
Okay. Make sure that everybody knows that I think it was a brilliant book. Really well done. Even if you do know quite a bit about, you know, UFOs and you bought all the books that came out, there's stories in here, like I said, that I haven't come across.
Well, I have to, tip my hat to three or four UFO researchers in particular, because I don't really consider myself a UFO researcher. You guys are UFO researchers. You have devoted a large part of your life to looking into this riddle. And so are the people who I talk to, which include Jerry Clark and Keith Chester and Richard Haynes and others. And those are the people I talk to on the phone in person, but also people like Valley and other people whose books that I used as research. And the thing is that I feel like my job in this, because I'm a writer, is to collect these stories that give the best example that it just seems that when we are at war, UFOs take a particular interest in us. It's like they are watching us kill each other. And I just thought that was fascinating. But I would never have been able to do it without the research of the people that I mentioned that had gone before. You know, That's why you see, you know, I know what you mean, that there are UFO stories that, you know, I read them today. I've read them, you know, years ago. But, you know, we were able to come up with ones that were a little bit obscure, but they kind of fit this pattern that we were going for. And that is that it just seems that when we're at war, somebody or something looking in on us.
Is paying attention. Exactly.
Well, I think one of our previous guests, actually fairly recently, his conclusion was that whenever wars occur is because probably they put us up to it.
Well, you know, who knows? That's part of the puzzle, isn't it?
That is, yeah, part of the puzzle.
Who knows what they're up to? Who knows the reason for any of it?
Uh-huh.
You know, they do exist. There's a quote in there that I had heard several other people say before, but I start one of the chapters with it, and it's simple. UFOs exist. We just don't know what they are.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I guess everybody has heard about the Foo Fighters. Tell us a little bit about some of the stories about that.
Well, the Foo Fighters take up a large section of the book, and that's because there's just so many documented cases of Allied air crews during World War II sighting unidentified flying objects. there were several different sizes and shapes to what people were seeing. But eventually they would come to be known as Foo Fighters. So many of these objects were seen by Allied crews over Germany, and let's just talk about the European theater for now, that what would happen is the air crews would come back to England and land, and the first thing you do after a bombing mission is that you talk to your intelligence officers. They debrief you to see what happened. Now, as Keith Chester told me, and we have in the book, around this time, science fiction was very popular in the late 30s and the 1940s, Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers, that type of thing. And that's what this sounded like. These air crews were seeing things that seemed like they're from a Flash Gordon or a Buck Rogers story. And these intelligence officers did not want to put anything in their reports, which went right up the ladder to higher command, that sounded science fiction-like. So there was a tendency to not include them at all. But then it got to the point where there were so many of them, they would include them, but only only a select number of people could see them, and in the higher-ups. And we're talking about both the American Allied Air Force commanders and also the British Air Force commanders. And what was happening then was you have to put yourself in the position of these people. They're number one goal is to win the war as quickly as possible. And what they were doing was just bombing the heck out of Germany as part of this whole overall effort to end the war. They didn't have the time or the resources or the interest in trying to figure out what these air crews were seeing. So from the British point of view, what the British just assumed these are just quote-unquote, super weapons, wonder weapons of Germany and of the Germans. And when the war is over, we'll find out what they are. And that's how they approached it. The Americans, you know, weren't so concrete about it. They were mystified by them. But again, they weren't in the business of figuring out what unidentified flying objects were. They're in the business of winning the war. So in a strange way, it took, you know, they had they got short shrift in a way of all these people seeing all these things, yet they were not in the position to do any kind of an investigation what they were, because winning the war was number one priority.
And since these Foo Fighters weren't shooting them down, it wasn't a problem.
Well, see, that's another thing, is that, you know, when one of the things that we get into in the book, and what people were thinking were, or some people were thinking that they were, and still to this day think that they were German super weapons, but that's impossible because, number one, once again, just like people were thinking that the Ghost Flyers were somehow German spy planes flying over Sweden for some reason in 1934, where would be the support structure for these fantastic weapons? Who invented them? How could the Germans have these fantastic weapons when in 1944 they were building their ME-262 jets with wooden cockpits? They were running out of oil. They were running out of ball bearings. They were running out of gasoline. You know, where is the manufacturing? Where are the factories that were making these quote-unquote super weapons? Plus, as you pointed out, there is no instance of these Foo Fighters ever shooting at any Allied plane. So if they were German super weapons, why weren't they shooting down all our bombers? Why weren't they immolating soldiers on the ground? They never showed any hostile intent. They were just there observing us. They were not Nazi super weapons. And frankly, in my opinion, people who kind of keep that idea going is just another way of keeping the vile policies of the Nazis going. They were not Nazi super weapons. They were something else.
What's interesting I found was the fact that you've written so many books on the military. You've been a military writer. Sure, your stories were nonfiction, but also you had to do probably a great deal of research. I mean, you know and I know that you have to back up what you're writing about, so you have to do a great deal of research. So you have this insight to the history of warfare, and so you're bringing a lot more to the table when you're writing about UFOs in during wartime, because you researched that extensively over your lifetime.
Right, that's true. And what I consciously tried to do anyway in this book is that to give a historical background to the episodes that we talk about in the book. So, you know, we talk about what it was like to be bombing Germany, let's say in 1942, as opposed to bombing Germany in 1945. In 1942, 500 American B-17s would leave on a bombing mission. 60, 70 of them would not come back. In 1945, they would do 1,000 plane raids, and they would have fighter escorts, and everyone would come back. So there's, you have to give a historical perspective to these things, and also, and which we tried to do in the book, and also you have to look at it from the point of view of in those early days when it was really, really a dangerous mission to fly over Germany without fighter escort to bomb some heavily defended German city and then to fly all the way back. These people were basically fighting for their lives. And in the midst of that, they are making UFO observations. They are seeing UFOs. It's my contention that there's no way that anyone in a position like that would make up a story about a flying saucer, UFO, a Foo Fighter, whatever you want to call it. They're not in the position to be concocting a story at that point. All they're trying to do is stay alive. That's why I think that these people are the best UFO witnesses we have, because there's no way that they're not telling the truth.
Right. They spent all night on a bombing mission and they spent that entire night in a life and death situation. Why would they come home, land on the ground safely, and then tell stories? It's
right.
Just
and
they're
exactly.
Still in shock.
Exactly. Yep.
And they're still running on adrenaline. Okay, there's a connection to the Foo Fighter information with the Roy Smith incident, and what is that?
Well, he was a pilot for the Royal Canadian Air Force. He was flying a RAF Halifax bomber in May of 1943, and they were heading to Essen, Germany, which was a large manufacturing town in Germany, in a very hot target, as they say. And one of 500 RAF planes, and just as they got over the target, and in the midst of being in the middle of flak and German night fighters, all of a sudden, he and his crew see this unbelievably large cylindrical object just pacing them along in the middle of all this confusion. Everybody on his airplane saw it, and that's another thing is that, you know, when you're talking about being in a bomber in the midst of a war, in the midst of being shot at, and you see one of these things, it's not just you. There's up to 9 people on some of these bombers, and in all cases, the entire crew saw these things. So he called out his crew, and they got a really good look at this thing. Oddly enough, it was almost Sub-Lieutenant Morgan saw over London back in 1915. It was long, so electrical. They could see portholes, windows in it. They just watched this thing for a long time, and then at some point, it just turned on the jets, and boom, gone. They estimated that it took off at a speed of 4,000 miles an hour and just disappeared in the stars overhead. And Smith, landed the plane back in England. He and his crew were debriefed by the intelligence officers, but once again, it's one of these things where the intelligence officers kind of downplayed it. They made notes on it, but they downplayed it because they didn't want word going around to all the Allied crews that these weird things were happening. Once again, they wanted them to just concentrate on the job at hand, and that was bombing German cities, getting the war over with.
Exactly.
So, Mac, I wanted to ask you, when is a rocket not a rocket?
Well, that's a good question. The Americans and the British kind of differed slightly on how to handle the whole Foo Fighter question. As I said, the Americans, what they would do is they would take the information from their crews. They would not make a big deal out of it. They would write it up in the reports, but they would be very choosy about exactly who saw those reports. The British were compelled to try to come up with an answer for these things, some kind of an excuse that to them made sense, even if the explanation didn't make sense. And this is when a rocket is not a rocket. The Germans had a weapon. Now the Germans did have some interesting weapons, but they were kind of like desperation weapons. And one of them was called an HE-193. And what that really was it was kind of like a very early cruise missile. You would drop it from the bottom of a Heinkel 111 German bomber. It had a small television screen in it and a radio control of the flaps. And a guy would be a crewman in the German bomber would be in a belly observation bubble. The HE-193 would drop out of the bottom of the plane, and he would guide it, watching the TV broadcast down to the surface. Now, what this was used for mostly was anti-shipping. They'd see some Allied ship. They'd launch this. It was pretty big. It was almost like a small airplane on its own, and they would guide this thing into the ship. More often than not, it didn't work. Sometimes it did work. When it did work, usually the reason for the ship sinking was kept secret. Anyway, what the British were saying was that there were instances where their crews would say that a object, a Foo Fighter, would come up in back of them. It would pace them. It would stay on their tail. It would switch from side to side. It would fly in front of them, above them, below them. It would be flying alongside with them for 10, 15 minutes. These cruise missiles that the Germans had that I was just talking about, they couldn't fly for more than a minute or two. They certainly could not fly in level flight. They could not maneuver at all, and they didn't take off at fantastic speeds. Yet, the British kind of just hooked onto those and said, they must be these rockets that our crews are seeing. And then when someone would say, well, how come they're doing all these maneuvers that seem impossible, the British just said, well, there must be malfunctions in their steering controls or something. They had to come up with some kind of an explanation. It didn't necessarily have to be a rational explanation, but they had to come up with a explanation. And they did, and that was it.
Okay, so they have different ways of handling the Foo Fighters situation as well as you know, the different countries having their own explanation. I guess the Americans didn't really explain anything. They just passed the information along, and the vast majority of those stories came out after the war was over when the pilots who had lived to talk about them.
That's right.
The interesting thing here is, and reading your book, is you offer sort of military insights at the end of the stories. You don't just tell the stories. At the end of the stories, what you do is you say, well, these are some of the explanations, and these are why militarily those explanations that the Army or the military gave or the Air Force gave at that time don't fit. So that's where your knowledge of military during the First and Second World Wars comes into play, because you can look at the official answers that the military was giving and going, and this is why it doesn't work. And I found that to be very interesting.
Well, a lot of times it's a matter of numbers too. It's a matter of, and a matter of common sense. Like I say, going back to the Foo Fighters, if everyone assumed that they were German super weapons, but you know, once again, who built them? Who designed them? Why would the Germans be flying around in antiquated airplanes like Stuka dive bombers when supposedly they had, you know, some kind of aerial machine that could go 4,000 miles an hour? Why didn't, after the war, when a lot of German scientists actually came to the United States and helped NASA put America on the moon, why didn't these people tell NASA about these things? The German scientists that went to Russia, why didn't they give these secrets to the Russians? Why wasn't some vast underground factory building German super weapons uncovered? None of this happened. At the end of the war, when they were debriefing the heads of the Luftwaffe and of the German military, because the German pilots would see these things too. So, I mean, basically, if you can imagine a scenario where they're sitting across a table from each other and the Allied debriefers were saying, we thought it was you, and the Germans said back to them, we thought it was you.
Right. So that does add something to it. Okay, I'm going to ask you about, what is the Old Crow incident?
The Old Crow incident is really an interesting story. Later on in the war, what they used to do is the Americans would bomb Germany during the day, and the British would bomb Germany at night. And that was the division of labor. But what they would do in cases of, let's say there was bad weather, or for whatever reason, there weren't a lot of large bombing raids going on, they used to ask the volunteers among the American flyers to go up just one plane, lone wolf missions, where they would go up, fly over Germany, unload a bunch of bombs over like a railroad station or some kind of an ammunition dump or an airfield. It was more like harassment more than anything. It would you know, light up all the German defenses, and then they would know where all the anti-aircraft gun emplacements were that would help them if they were going to bomb this target during the day and so on. There was a lot of reasons to do it, but you know, it was kind of a risky mission, these lone wolf missions. So anyway, there was this crew, and the name of their B-17 was the Old Crow, and they took off from a airfield in Italy and flew up to Austria, which was in German hands. And their first target was, they had some mechanical problems, so they actually diverted to a second target. As they're going over the second target, and they're going to unload their bombs on this railway station, the entire airplane is just flooded with light. Now, and this is right at the moment that they're going to release their bomb. So once you're in the bombing run, you can't divert from it. So they go through the bombing run, and everyone in the airplane is just bathed in this light. They think it's German searchlights, so powerful that they're coming right in every opening, every window of the airplane. And if you're caught in the searchlights, then anti-aircraft fire is going to follow, and you're probably going to get shot down. They drop their bombs, and they turn to get out of there, and the light stays with them, and they realize that this isn't searchlights at all. What it is they're being paced by this orb, a very, very, very bright orb, is how the pilot of the B-17 described it later on. It was flying up just a couple hundred feet off their wing. It stayed with them for almost the entire flight back to Italy, which was, you know, about 2 hours or so. Everybody on the plane got a good look at it. They described it as a perfect circle, glowing on its own, showing no hostile intent. The pilot of the captain of the plane said, "Don't fire at it." It wasn't showing any kind of hostile intent, as I say. And so what we had is this situation where this entire crew was able to watch this, you know, this thing for a couple hours. And then as soon as they were approaching their airbase, it took off one direction. They landed. Later on, the debriefers said, well, this must have been some kind of a balloon or something that the Germans had shown up. Nope, it wasn't a balloon. It must have been some kind of a new weapon that the Germans had somehow come up with. Nope, it wasn't, because it didn't fire on them. It was a Foo Fighter. It was a UFO. It was a UFO that was watching that airplane for almost its entire mission. It's a really fascinating story.
Observing the entire mission. Right. Yeah, they have a lot of stories of this observation thing going on, and that leads into the Tromp incident.
Well, the Tromp incident is interesting, and I'll just back up a little bit. A lot of the Foo Fighter stories before I started the book seem to have come from the European theater. Most of the incidents of Foo Fighters during World War II came from the European theater. But there are actually a number of episodes in the Pacific Theater, too. And once again, thanks to Keith Chester, who was able to research these things, I was able to put them in the book. And one of them was this incident that had to do with a Dutch cruiser called the Tromp. And it was in February 1942, so the war in the Pacific had just really begun. And it was sailing near New Guinea when all of a sudden this the crewmen on this cruiser were looking out for a Japanese aircraft when they spotted this huge saucer-shaped object above the ship and moving at really, really tremendous speed. People watched it approaching, and as it got to the ship, it slowed down and it began to circle the cruiser. And the captain was informed, and the entire crew came up on the deck and saw this thing. And it stayed with, now the cruiser is moving at this point, probably moving maybe about 15 knots or so. This thing stayed circling above the Tromp for 4 hours, keeping pace with it. So many people saw it. The entire crew was out on the deck watching this thing for 4 hours that it's an incident where it had a lot of witnesses, one of the incidents in the Pacific that had a large number of witnesses. There were several similar incidents to this. And then at the end of the 4 hours, all of a sudden, the thing just broke its orbit going around the ship and accelerated to 3,500 miles an hour and was gone. Of course, nothing back then could go over 400 or 500 miles an hour. This thing, you know, took off at around Mach 6 and was gone. Just a really incredible story.
And the other thing is, any conventional craft might run out of fuel.
Right.
Or at least, you know, be worried about that thing.
Right. That's another thing. You know, once again, we go back to the numbers. You know, these objects that we're seeing circling ships, there was another incident with a battleship, the USS New York, an American battleship, where one just, you know, stayed with it for hours. It's impossible for that to have been a Japanese aircraft because they would have run out of fuel at that point. I mean, never mind the fact that they would, you know, would take off at Mach 5 or 6. You wouldn't have the fuel to pace a ship for that long. So it wasn't anything from any military that we knew about in the 1940s.
Right. And the connection to that is several things that are connected would be the Tasmania sighting and the formation over Tulagi. Did I say that correctly?
Right, yes. The Tasmania sighting was interesting because a pilot in the Royal Australian Air Force was on patrol when he encountered this pretty mysterious object. It was shaped like a large airfoil, and it had a dome on it, and he could actually see into the dome someone wearing a helmet, but this thing was not of any design of those days. And this object kept pace with him for a while, once again watching, observing, and then all of a sudden it went straight down into the water, into the Pacific, and was gone. There are a number of instances where people saw UFOs either going into the water or coming out of the water. And of course, in the Pacific Theater was mostly water. And like I said, there are a number of stories where people saw UFOs coming and going from underneath the sea. And of course, there's a lot of people these days who are really into unidentified submersed objects. So maybe there's a connection there.
Yeah, I also remember the stories about the UFOs hitting the water and not making a splash.
Uh-huh.
They would just slip in like they were like you were putting your finger in mercury. It wouldn't make a splash, you know. Uh-huh. It would just slide in. So the formation over Tulagi.
This was again. This was another one of the first stories that I came upon. Tulagi is a small island in the Solomon Islands, and its one claim to fame is that later on in the war it became a PT boat base, and that's where John F. Kennedy, who went on to be president of the United States, he was assigned there, and the famous story is they went out one night, he and his PT boat crew, and they were sliced in half by a Japanese destroyer, and he rescued most of his crew, and they were on an island, a deserted island in Japanese territory for a few days, and he was able to make contact with an Australian coast watcher who arranged for them to be picked up and saved. You know, really quite a heroic story on its own. But anyway, earlier in the war, the Marines had to invaded this island. It was a Japanese-held island, and it really tough fighting, as a lot of those island-hopping campaigns were. But just one day after a long night of fighting, a lot of the Marines were in their foxholes. They're waiting for the next Japanese attack to come, and they hear this roar of something coming up in the sky. They think it might be Japanese bombers or whatever, and what they see instead is dozens, up to 150 of these round objects in long lines, flying in formation, going over the island. Many, many people saw them, and they said that the noise they made was unlike anything they'd ever seen before. And one quote from one of the Marines who saw it was that it was something along the lines of, now here's a guy who is fighting in the Pacific, which is really, really tough, awful, horrible fighting. And he said this formation that he saw fly over this island was the most frightening thing he'd ever seen in his life. Awe-inspiring, but frightening.
Right, because, I mean, they were dealing with nitty-gritty, mud and rain and fighting and blood and gore. And, you know, constantly these guys are in flooded with adrenaline. You know, they don't know whether, you know, they're going to live or die. And he sees something like that, and that scares him, which is surprising, really.
Right, right. And it goes back to what we were talking about before, is that military personnel in the middle of combat or awaiting combat or just after combat, to make a UFO observation under those conditions, they're the best witnesses we have, because they're not about to concoct a story under those situations.
Right.
Tell us something about the tales of the 415.
Well, the 415 Night Fighter Squadron, this is a really interesting story from World War II. I'll just do a quick background. The 415 Night Fighters, they flew a British airplane called the Bow Fighter, and it was kind of like two engines, large plane. It was considered a heavy fighter, and it moved pretty quickly. What made it especially adaptable for night fighting was that it had a large nose, and later on in the war, they were able to put a radar in there. And if you have a radar in your airplane and you can connect with the radar station on the ground, you can do intercepts of anything that's flying around up there at night. So they would go hunting at night for German airplanes. They were able to, for instance, see trains that were moving, things of that nature. So for whatever it was with the 415, was they bounced around the North Africa for a while. They were in Italy for a while, and they finally wind up in France. And this is, again, towards the end of the war. They would go up every night, and for whatever reason, these people saw, the people in this squadron saw more Foo Fighters per capita, let's say, than any other unit in the war. Who knows why? I mean, of course, they were flying at night, but there were a lot of planes up there flying at night. But they would see, I think at one point, in a month's time, they had 28 reported sightings of Foo Fighters. And the strange thing is that these were the people who gave the name Foo Fighters to these objects that people were seeing. Just, they had seen so many of them that they said, we have to name these things. And at the time, there was a comic strip, and there was a character in the comic strip who would he had a fire truck, and his name of his fire truck was Foo Fighter, and that's how this name Foo Fighters came about. These people saw so many Foo Fighters last months of the war that there was a quote from one of them saying that, you know, if these things aren't German wonder weapons, we've seen so many of them. If they're not German wonder weapons, then we're all ready for Section 8s. Because if they weren't German, they couldn't imagine what they were. So what happened was the war ended, And another interesting thing is that as soon as the war ended in Europe, all reports of Foo Fighters went away. As soon as the war was over, there were not any Foo Fighters seen again. And I think that's interesting in that they're here during war, but when the war is over, there's nothing for them to observe anymore. So they're gone. And the commander of this, of the 415, he was quoted as saying that he in the end thought, you know, these things, they had to be from someplace else, because he saw them, how they flew, and how many there were. He says when they found out after the war was over that they found no secret German weapons, he says there's only one other place these things could have come from, and that's from someplace else.
Right. I guess when the war was over and they won, all the places that they were, all the facilities, the weapons manufacturing facilities, they kept thinking, oh, we'll eventually come on these wonder facilities that were creating these amazing observational orbs that were checking us out, and they never did.
And they never did. I mean, not one instance of any kind of evidence that any of these things were being manufactured or flown by the Germans. And once again, and the same thing happened in the Pacific Theater. There's a story in the book about a radar station, Navy radar station on an island of Tarawa, which was a place where it was really, really bloody fighting at the beginning of the war. And once the Americans took it over, they had these huge radar stations there covering most of the Pacific. And one day they see something flying over 800 miles an hour, coming over 800 miles an hour, unheard of speed at that time. And they call the brass, and the brass is looking at the radar screens, and as they're doing that, another one shows up, flying right overhead, 800 miles an hour. No one knows what it was. At the end of the war, the Navy was debriefing some Japanese admirals who were in the naval aviation part of the Japanese Navy, and they asked them about it, and the Japanese admiral said, you know, we really have no idea what you're talking about. We didn't have anything with that capability. So once again, it's one of these things that it's a mystery. There's no answer to a lot of these things. There's no answer to what these were. We can only talk about them by how they acted. And what it was they watched us during the war. When the war was over, they left.
Right. And so that begs the questions. What did the Germans and the Japanese know about Foo Fighters? Not much.
Well, not much. There's a few instances in the book where there were reports that German pilots saw them as well. There's a story in there about Goebbels and a couple other high Nazis were watching the launch of a V-2 rocket, and this orb came down and circled the rocket as it was taking off, and Goebbels said, you know, what was that? And they blamed it on his people said, well, we think that that's some kind of a new British invention. There were other stories about German pilots intercepting very, very large objects over Norway and over Germany, running into the same situation that Allied pilots were, seeing these things that didn't make any sense. And the only conclusion that you could make at the time is this must be some kind of top-secret enemy aircraft. But once again, as we were saying, once the war was over, one side said to the other, weren't those yours? And the other side said, no, we thought they were yours. And everyone just kind of winds up, you know, shrugging their shoulders. What could they be? They never found out.
Okay. Another story here. What are the ghost rockets of Scandinavia?
This is probably my second favorite chapter of the book. Right after World War II ended, 1946. The war is over, and all of a sudden, over the same parts of Sweden where people were seeing the ghost flyers in 1934, all of a sudden people start seeing these, what came to be known as ghost rockets. And what they were rockets flying over Sweden. There were hundreds of them seen during the spring and summer of 1946. They would fly over cities. They would fly over the country. Military people saw them. They were chased by Swedish military planes. It got so bad that the Swedish, who are historically neutral, secretly asked the British to send them some radar sets, and they did. The British provided them with radar, and now these things started being picked up on radar. Two very famous Americans secretly went to Sweden in 1946, one of them being Jimmy Doolittle, who was the leader of the famous 30 Seconds Over Tokyo raid. He was briefed by the Swedish officials, and at first, everyone thought that they might have been coming from a German rocket base called Peenemünde, where a lot of V-1s and V-2s were built and launched. It was now part of East Germany. It was now in Russian hands, and there was a theory that maybe the Russians had reconstituted this rocket base and for some reason were shooting rockets over Sweden. But again, let's get back to the numbers. Hundreds and hundreds of them were seen. And on a good day, the Germans could only launch about 15 V-1 rockets. And they weren't coming from Peenemünde anyway, because when they finally were able to do some recon over it, they saw that Peenemünde was basically deserted, and anything that the Russians could find after that the Germans didn't destroy, they just moved to Poland. So just like the ghost flyers, no one ever figured out what the ghost rockets were. But the interesting thing was, it was the first time a military, the Swedish military, you know, documented saying that we think these things are not of this earth. And there were some U.S. Military officials who, you know, consulted with them, and they really came to the same conclusion. But the very odd thing is that one of the defense ministers for Sweden was interviewed years later about this, and he said that what he saw, eyewitnesses were describing these things matched to a T what we see today as cruise missiles. And his quote is that the description is exactly what we see today as cruise missiles. But what's a cruise missile doing flying over Sweden in 1946?
Mm-hmm. And these things never landed anywhere, and there weren't any big explosions.
No explosions. The odd thing about it is that people would see them going into lakes. For some reason, it was like they were being directed into lakes. And there was one that fell into a lake that a lot of people saw, and the Swedish military immediately cordoned off the lake and sent down divers to look at the bottom, but nothing was ever found from them. Just a really kind of strange story all around, and it got me thinking that, you know, what does this mean? Why are we seeing 1990 technology in 1946? It didn't make any sense, but, I mean, you know, from all the evidence, cruise missiles were flying over Sweden in 1946.
Maybe there was a time warp time.
Well, you know, maybe there was. I mean, we can go back to another incident that we didn't talk about, you know, and that's the scare ships of 1909. People in England started seeing what they at first thought were Zeppelins going overhead. At the time, everyone just assumed that Germany and England would go to war at some point, and they did go to war 5 years later, but there were definitely war scares around. But what people were seeing was, even though they were maybe the size and the shape of Zeppelin, these things were the scare ships. They were clocked at going 200 miles an hour. Even today's blimps can't go more than 50 miles an hour, but these things were actually clocked by a newspaper going 200 miles an hour, flying against the wind. Once again, they had searchlights hanging from the bottom of them, and people thought that they might be spy ships. Well, you don't spy with searchlights in the middle of the night, and German military Zeppelins had not advanced to the point that they could go to fly over England and back. It was a 700-mile trip at night until 1914 and 1915 or so. So here's another example where it seems like you're witnessing a technology that's just a little bit ahead of its time. The same thing with the ghost flyers. You know, people were seeing these airplanes in 1934 that were impossible in 1934, but maybe probable 10 years later. In 1946, people are seeing cruise missiles. You know, impossible technology for the time, but 30 years later, not so impossible. So who knows what's going on, but there are instances where it seems like people saw weapons technology that was just, for some reason, ahead of its time.
So tell me something. What do you think this thing could have been? Why does it seem that this phenomena is not that far ahead of us, or, you know, that particular times that things are being seen. Because even today we have the same thing. We see things that, you know, they're not that far-fetched, technology-wise.
I don't know. I wish I had the answer. If I had the answer, then, the puzzle may be solved. I have no idea. The more I read, the more research I did, the stranger the stories got. I hope someday someone finds out. At the end of the book, during the course of researching it, I had asked a number of these UFO researchers, when do you think the UFO puzzle will be solved? And they all agree that the problem is that the scientific community does not want to study UFOs. They'll spend $10 billion to make the large Hadron superconductor in Switzerland to find out, you know, what's happening in the first trillionth of a second of the Big Bang. And yet you have this unbelievable mystery. Yet the scientific community is too afraid for their careers and so on and so forth. They don't want to get into it. But Jerry Clark said, his quote was that he thought in about 50 years the scientific community would get around to studying UFOs. And once you get really good science studying them, then you're that much closer to an answer. But what do I think it is? I really don't know. I wish I could even hazard a guess, but I don't know.
I wonder if 50 years ago, when somebody asked another person who was maybe interested in this and looking into it, when do you think they're going to be talking about it openly, and when do you think we're going to know more about it? And I wonder if that person says, I figure in about 50 years.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And I'll just add something, too, is it probably won't be us, and when I say us, in the West, who figure it out. I mean, the way things are going, it's probably going to be someone in China or India who figures it out.
Right, because, I mean...
Well, I mean, the UFO subject is so complex that it is not one thing. You know, you're not dealing with one type of phenomenon.
Right. I will tell you a theory I have, though. And it's kind of funny how I came to it. And it has to do with how I work. And this is going to sound a little crazy, but stay with me, okay? When I work, I sit at a computer and I get all my research around me, but I always have the television on with the sound turned down. And for whatever reason, while I was writing this book, I always had the television turned to the animal channel, okay? Because I wouldn't pay attention to it. I don't know, even know why the TV's on, but that's just the way that I work. And I would look at it occasionally, and there would be, you know, pictures of people in Africa and tracking lions and leopards and all this stuff. And then one night it just hit me. You know, what are the UFOs doing that we can relate to what we do? And the thing that came to me was that, let's say you want a trip for a safari. I want a trip to Africa. Okay, so what are you going to do? You're going to fly from where you are to Africa. You're going to get to a place in Africa, and they're going to put you on a truck. And the truck is going to go out into, the Serengeti or someplace, and you're going to observe lions attacking gazelle and zebra, and you're going to observe everything that goes on, in Africa. Now, the animals will see you, but they don't know what you're doing. They can't understand what a truck is, what a tourist is, why you're looking at them. You're there. You're watching them. But they basically can't understand who you are or what you are. So they're going going about their daily business. Well, it's almost like the same thing. What we're talking about here is UFOs observing us. It's almost like, if you can imagine, maybe there's a time in the future where people will actually come back in time and watch us, watch history before their eyes, in a way. So it would be odd if UFOs were just like some kind of time-traveling tourist. But there's a lot of things that kind of connect in that scenario. But again, I don't know. That's just something that came to me one night.
Yeah, yeah. I'd just like to say to the people in the future, I think you're a little bit sick coming back to check out us murdering each other. I know, personally, I would have went to an opera. Just me.
Well, maybe some are. You never know.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
We just, you know, we just happen to be seeing, or they happen to be seeing the people who are you know, war historians.
Yeah, I think generally what's going to happen is, and this sort of maybe is a connection, is the tourists aren't necessarily going to get out of the truck while a lion's, you know, ripping a gazelle's throat out and walk up and start snapping pictures. So they're going to stay in their truck and just sort of observe what's going on. They're not going to get personally involved because, you know, there's a lot of threat going on at that moment.
Right.
Now, later on, when it's a little bit more peaceful, you have the example of the people that track down animals and shoot them with needles.
Right, exactly.
And then they go and tag them and, right. And this sort of thing.
It's close to abductions, you know. It's close to what people report as abductions.
Abductions, exactly.
And yeah, but then, you know,
maybe
even,
you know, you might get some. So you got people doing research now, trying to communicate with dolphins. You know what I mean? There is different levels to it, possibly.
Right.
Yeah, but you know, this phenomena has always been just slightly ahead of our technology. Okay, even whether you go back 100 years or. You know, look at it now. The abduction phenomenon is a perfect example. You know, they can come through walls, you know, take the person wherever they take him. But the technology of, you know, the implants and the type of things that they do to them is not much different than ours.
Right, right. You know? See, that's what I mean. It always seems like it's whatever's happening is just like a little bit ahead. It's just like right. A little bit ahead. It's like something is, you know, doesn't line up exactly.
What I think is that somebody's playing a very cruel joke on Hasid.
that could be. I've thought of that too. Is that, you know, that it's all just one big cosmic joke on us?
Right. I don't know if it really fits with the ancient antiquity and cave drawings. I think, you know, in terms of a little bit ahead, it doesn't really fit. And if you go back to medieval times and stuff like that with you know, saucers in the sky and
yeah,
massive, and the Rig Veda talking about massive war going on in the skies above them. You know, I mean, that doesn't really
but
fit.
See, this is the funny thing. Back in, if you go back to hundreds of years ago, yes, you know, the technology was, you know, seemed to be way far ahead. But what's been happening in the last, you know, let's call it 70, 80 years, right? The stories that have come out from, you know, the late 1800s and on seem to just be that whoever these characters are, they're just slightly ahead of us, you know? And it seems that there's something different, you know, that they have might have been from the past.
Well, along those same lines, look at it this way, too, is that you are in these aerial vehicles that can turn on a dime, that can accelerate to 4,000 or 5,000 miles an hour, that are huge, that are just fantastic in every possible way. Why then, if you're observing us, do you have to fly 100 feet off the wing of a B-17 bomber? You know, we have the Hubble telescope. We can look billions of years, you know, back in time. We can look billions of...
There's so many questions and so many... You know, bizarre situations in this phenomenon.
So close to observe, you know, when they're in these fantastic machines. So there's really no explanations for it. But I think, and I hope Jerry Clark is right, that, you know, maybe in our lifetimes or in our children's lifetimes, this puzzle will be solved.
I certainly hope so.
So let's go to the, I guess, the most famous flying saucer story, the Kenneth Arnold.
Okay, Kenneth Arnold was a businessman. He flew his own private plane, and on June 24th in 1947, he was flying in the state of Washington, flying near Mount Rainier, when off to his left he saw these objects. There was a line of them. They were moving very fast. He determined later on that they were moving about, you know, 4,000 miles an hour, and they were moving in unison in between the mountain peaks. Now, he, you know, observed them for quite a while, for like about 4 or 5 minutes, and he he knew that this was not some other airplane, you know, that he had ever seen. It was just something so unusual that when he landed in Yakima, Washington, he mentioned it to a few people. And his idea was these had to be secret weapons of the Air Force. He left Yakima and he flew on to Pendleton, Oregon. But by that time, someone had told his story to the press, and all of a sudden he has reporters asking him about what happened. So he repeated the story over and over, and soon enough it got on to the news wires. And one of the quotes that he said was that these things looked like a saucer skipping along the top of the water. And from that, reporters somewhere took that and he coined the term flying saucer. Now, that did two things in my mind. Number one, it made the UFO story American, if you know what I mean. Because now, and by America, I mean North America, because here we are, we're post-war, we are growing, our communications have, you know, growing. We have radio, TV is soon to come, newspapers are linked. It's the beginning of mass media. These things were going on, UFO sightings or flying saucer sightings or unidentified aerial object sightings, as we've been talking about all night, had been going on way before 1947. But suddenly, this was something that was in the press. And people, as soon as Arnold was quoted as saying, I saw flying saucers, all of a sudden, people were seeing flying saucers all over the country, all over the U.S. And that's how the term flying saucer got coined. And suddenly, you have Roswell now. You have hundreds and hundreds of UFOs being spotted. The Air Force is concerned. They think that they're Russians. They think that they're that the Russians have secret weapons flying over the U.S. They don't know what to do. But it all started with Kenneth Arnold that day flying over Mount Rainier and seeing these things and saying they look like saucers skipping across the water. And that's how the term flying saucer was coined. Now, I can go on to the Maury Island incident.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you about the Maury Island incident. How is that connected?
It's a very, very, very strange story. And I know there's a lot of people out there who think that it was a hoax, but I read so much literature and research on this. Personally, I can't believe it was a hoax. I really think it happened, but I'll quickly tell you the story. A few days before Kenneth Arnold saw his, you know, the flying saucers, there was a gentleman and a couple of people in a boat. His son was one of them, and his dog was with them. And he had this business where he would retrieve logs that went into the water off of Tacoma, Washington. He would retrieve them for there's a lot of lumber businesses there, and he'd pull these logs and give them back to the lumber company so they wouldn't be wasted. This man's name was Harold Dow. And so they were out retrieving logs, and all of a sudden they see these six objects above them. Now, this is 3 or 4 days before Kenneth Arnold saw his. They were so low that the people in the boat got concerned, and they went to the shore. One of these objects seemed to be in trouble. It started excreting the stuff that looked like slag. The other saucers kind of rallied around it. It looked like some kind of an electrical charge was put into the ailing saucer. It regained strength, and boom, off they take off at tremendous speed, now leaving the people who had landed on Maury Island just astonished. They had no idea what's going on. They go back to the mainland, and Dow doesn't tell anybody. The next day, a gentleman shows up at his house. He thinks he's an insurance person, or maybe someone from the government. They wind up having breakfast together, and this person basically threatens him to keep his mouth shut, and it's really like the first instance in America, anyway, of a Man in Black episode, where you have someone who possibly could work for the government basically intimidating a witness to keep his mouth shut about flying saucers. So anyway, but Donald does not take his advice, and he goes and he tells his boss what happened, and the boss at some point communicates with a magazine in Chicago, a science magazine, And they want to do a story on what happened at Maury Island. And the Dahl and his boss agree. And who does the science magazine send to Washington to do the story but Kenneth Arnold? Now, this is about a month after his sighting, and all of a sudden, now he's turned into a UFO reporter. So Kenneth Arnold flies into Tacoma. He's met with Dahl and this guy named Fred Christman, who's Dahl's boss. They go into a hotel room, and Kenneth Arnold is going to interview them for the story. Christman, the boss, said that he'd went to Maury Island the next day because he was skeptical of what Dahl had told him, and he said he also saw a UFO there, and he took some of the slag that they said that they saw the UFO excreting. So now they're in this hotel room, and Arnold is interviewing them, and they get a phone call, and it's from a newspaper reporter, and he's saying, I have a guy on the other line who is telling me everything you are talking about in that hotel room. And Arnold can't believe it. None of them can. They search the entire room for a bug or something, and they can't find it. Yet, the reporter's on the phone saying, he's repeating back to them exactly what they're saying. They can't understand what is going on. At that point, someone says, we should get the military involved. So they make it through a long series of connections. Two Air Force officers fly up from a base in California. They arrive in Tacoma, and they join them the next day in this hotel room. So now the five of them are in there. And once again, this reporter is saying that, he calls up and says, I'm being told everything you are talking about in this room. Somehow or other, someone was able to look in that room, hear them, and see them. The military officers, their intelligence officers, they're flying a B-25 light bomb, just as a transport aircraft. They debrief Arnold and Dahl and Christman. They take some of the slag with them. They get back on their airplane, and they're going to fly back to California and make their report. Within a half hour of taking off, those two guys are dead. Their plane crashes, not far away from where Arnold saw the first flying saucers. Well, this sets off a chain of events where the local newspapers, you know, they find out that these people were meeting about the seeing flying saucers off Maury Island. All of a sudden, you have these intelligence officers who are dead under mysterious circumstances. At this point, Arnold says, I don't want to do this anymore. He calls the magazine in Chicago, says, I can't do the story. He gets in his plane. He takes off, and it turns out that his plane almost crashes. And it's only that he was such a skilled pilot that he was able to land, or he would have died. No one ever found out, you know, whether someone had sabotaged the engine or what, but it was a close call for him. And at that point, he was out of the UFO reporting business. Now, this story kind of took on a life of its own. Dahl, the guy who originally saw the UFOs, he became ill. His wife became insane. His son went missing. He had all these really bad things happen to him. A lot of people accused them of perpetrating a hoax, yet the FBI got involved. The FBI determined it was not a hoax. Some UFO researchers who have got into it have determined that what it really is, it looks like a thinly veiled intelligence operation. Who knows what really happened, but I think that the fascinating thing is that this Fred Christman, Dahl's boss, who was kind of a character on his own, flash forward, 20 years or so, and Dealey Plaza, November 22nd, 1963, John F. Kennedy is shot. Three people are arrested walking the tracks nearby. Somehow one of them has a connection to Christman. Christman is called before a committee investigating the assassination of John F. Kennedy. What's the connection between UFOs and that? Who knows? It's just a very, very, very strange UFO story.
Yeah, definitely. Tales from the Cold War, One Spaceman's Story. I thought that was a great title.
Now, the Korean War is going on. It's the early 50s. Korean War is going on, and there's a lot of UFOs being seen over Korea. Korea is only about one-third the size of Texas, and all of a sudden you have lots of jet fighters flying around. These jet fighters now have radar sets in them, so not only are they picking up UFOs on ground radar, but a lot of UFOs being picked up on radars that are on these airplanes. Meanwhile, in Germany, tensions are getting very high between Russia and the West. Germany is divided, communist on one side, democracies on the other. And at a base in Germany, one day early in the 50s, all of a sudden they see a vast armada of cylindrical shapes going overhead. This base, which is a fighter interceptor base, they're there to stop Russian MiGs should there be an invasion by the Russians. They scramble, they take off, they fly as high as they can go in their F-84s, and they can't go any higher, and these things are actually still high above them, and they're able to see them, and they look like flying saucers, and there are hundreds of them. But they can't intercept them, so all they do is observe them. This goes on for 2 or 3 days. The people at the base report it to the Pentagon. No one in the Pentagon does anything, or if they do anything, it's never relayed back to the people at the base in Germany. Finally, they stop trying to intercept these things, and they just simply stay on the ground and watch them through binoculars. It went on for more than a week, and it was just another fantastic UFO story with hundreds and hundreds of UFOs being spotted. One of the pilots in the squadron at the time was Gordon Cooper. Gordon Cooper went on to be one of the first of 7 American astronauts. The Tom Wolfe, the Right Stuff story. He later wrote a book, and he was a firm believer in UFOs. As he said, I know what I saw. I can tell the difference between an airplane and something that isn't an airplane, and what was flying over our base in Germany that day, in the early 50s, was not an airplane. So then you have the 50s, which stretches out, and there's, again, a long section in the book, which is just, I tried to get the 10 best stories from the 50s, and there are just some unbelievable stories from the 50s. But I end that section with a story. Now we're out at Moorock in California, and two guys are out. This is Edwards Air Force Base, which is the major test facility for the U.S. Air Force. Two guys are out on a runway early in the morning. They're setting up a camera, and all of a sudden, this UFO comes over their heads and lands in front of them. And these guys have a camera. They have a still camera, and they have a movie camera. And they take pictures of it. Still pictures and movie pictures. Then they run back to the base. And who is the commanding officer? It's Gordon Cooper. He's now a test pilot. And they tell him what's happened. And he says, oh, my God, did you get pictures of it? And they said, we have still pictures. We have movies. So he calls, as he put it, there's a special number in the Pentagon that you call when something like this happened. He talks to a general. The general says, don't develop the film. Put it on the base commander's private plane. Get it to Washington as quick as you can. Now, Gordon Cooper did not see the movie footage, but he saw the negatives of the still pictures. And he said it was exactly what these guys said. It was a flying saucer. It landed on 3 struts. It stayed there for a while, and then maybe someone inside observed them getting their picture taken, and it took off. Now, this is in Edwards Air Force Base, a top secret test facility, probably one of the most secure places in the United States, and you have a flying saucer landing there, getting its picture taken, getting movies of it taken, and then it takes off. Gordon Cooper thinks at that point, finally, we have documented evidence of flying saucers. He thinks that they're going to come to him and debrief him, debrief the two guys who took pictures of it, and what happened was nothing happened. He never heard one word about it again. And that convinced him that the military, the Air Force, the people that he had devoted his life to, his career to, were covering this up. What amazes me is that it didn't stop him from becoming one of the astronauts, one of the 7 original astronauts. But he was someone who saw it firsthand at the beginning of the 50s and at the end of the 50s. And it was just a way to kind of sandwich, to bookend what happened in the 50s with UFOs.
Yeah, he opened and closed the 50s chapter.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
So it's very interesting. I was curious about the, like you mentioned, the Men in Black and what was some of the early stories of the Men in Black. Do you have any more of those in your research? And
well, the first Men in Black story I could that I came up with was happened during the scare ships that we were talking about in 1909. Once again, people were seeing these things fly overhead. They looked sort of like Zeppelins, but they were not acting like Zeppelins. They were going much too fast, and they were displaying things that Zeppelins just could not do. One of them was spotted on this by this gentleman who lived on a cliff on the eastern part of England, and he saw one go over that night. The next day, he goes out onto his lawn, and he finds this odd thing. He described it looked like a harpoon through a soccer ball, and he had no idea what it was, so he called the local Coast Guard. They came up and looked at it, and the police came up and looked at it, and they had no idea what it was either. So they asked him to hide it until someone from the military could come in and examine it. So he did that. So then the next day, he happened to put it in his barn. The next day, his servant is leaving to go do something, and she spots these two guys dressed in black, and they're kind of snooping around on the cliff, at the edge of the cliff. And they go into the barn, and they're looking around for the object. At this point, it had actually been taken away by the British military. But the servant, you know, asked them what they were doing, and they, you know, responded to her in some kind of odd language. And then she just was frightened, ran back in the house, and these guys disappeared. Now, throughout the whole scare ship thing, there were other reports of these characters dressed in black, speaking foreign language, some kind of foreign language, showing up in places where the scare ships would show up. Some people theorized that they were German spies. Maybe they're trying to figure out what the scare ships were themselves. But once again, after the war was over, no one ever came forward and said, I was the person who was doing this, or there was never any research found that there were these people, German agents in England, hanging around where scare ships were sighted. It's just one of these things. They disappeared. No one could ever explain who these guys were. But, you know, in my mind, that's one of the first Men in Black episodes ever.
Oh, yeah. And they reoccur through time. I mean, over and over and over, they reoccur. Yeah. So I'm going to just ask you now, let's go to our current time and during our current war period. Do you have a story that you found particularly interesting from, say, in the last, 15 years that you can relate that's more modern times?
Right. The book ends with the first Gulf War, which was in 1991. There were persistent reports, and I saw, and I kept coming upon these stories that that an American F-16 shot down a UFO during the first Gulf War. A lot of that information that I found came from Russia. But basically, here's the story. Four F-16s are on a bombing mission to Baghdad, and they spot a blip on their radar screen. They think it might be an Iraqi jet fighter or whatever. One of them is vectored towards it, and it turns out it's a UFO. Now, this is one of the few instances where apparently a UFO took some kind of hostile action, because as the story goes, the UFO shot at the F-16, the F-16 shoots back, hits them with two missiles, the UFO blows up and crashes into the Saudi Arabian desert. This Russian military attaché officer, a colonel, hears about this, and he flies out to the crash site, and he gets there before the Americans do, but there's a number of Saudis there, and the Russian officer is there with some of his men. And what he saw, what he says he saw, was a saucer, about a third of it destroyed. You could see inside, there were chairs for two. There's always two for some reason. And small controls, hieroglyphics on the control panels, things like that. And at that point, Americans show up and they clear everyone away. They crate it up and they ship it back to America. Now, like I said, I kept coming upon that story so many times, I thought I have to put that in there. Now, flash forward a little bit further. After the first Gulf War, what happened was this kind of war of attrition with Iraq, where the Americans were bombing his anti-aircraft batteries almost on a daily basis. There was a no-fly zone over Iraq for a lot of the mid-90s. And of course, this is all leading up to the second Gulf War. There was, again, a persistent report that kept coming back that at one point the Iraqis shot down a UFO over Baghdad during this kind of war of attrition. And they said that it was, that the UFO was almost intact and was brought to the Iraqi version of Area 51. And that Iraqi scientists or engineers or military people were reverse engineering this thing. And one theory was that, you know how they went to war in Iraq to looking for the weapons of mass destruction. They couldn't find them. But one theory is that that's what they were looking for. Now, do I believe that? I don't know. Like I say, I'm just a writer. I feel like I'm a reporter. And if I come upon a good story, I feel like I should, you know, report it. But it is kind of a fascinating twist to it, and it does kind of fill in a few holes. You know, why couldn't they find chemical weapons, nuclear weapons? Well, maybe because that wasn't what they were looking for.
Yeah, I think there's multiple answers to that. It seems when they went into to Baghdad, they made a beeline for the museums as well and knew exactly where they were going when they went into the museums. There's a lot of stories about them raiding the Iraqi museums and taking a lot of the ancient Sumerian tablets and a lot of the Sumerian.
It was chaos.
Yeah, and just you know, shipping them back to America. So it was crazy. It was crazy, really. Well, I think we've covered a small section, parts of the book. You guys should probably get this book, UFOs in Wartime, What They Didn't Want You to Know, because we, like I said, we've just covered a few stories just to entertain you, and he's detailed so many different stories. Do you have a number on the amount of stories that are in there? I mean, it's quite a bit.
Yeah, I think it's, there might be as many as 70, you know, individuals. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. I'm going to have to sit down and count them because there was a lot I didn't put in, too.
Right.
You know, there was. I had to kind of decide, you know, which ones were the most unique and which ones kind of, you know, followed the flow of the story, if you know what I mean.
Right. Well, you picked some pretty unique ones because a lot of them I hadn't heard of. And, I've been researching this for a while. So you definitely did your job in picking out unique ones. And we missed whole wars in this, but we only have so much time. I recommend in the upcoming show section tonight, there's a link to buy the book. Tomorrow it'll be in the past guests section of the website. If you want to just go there and click on the buy book here, you can get it. It'll be out in, you said, in the first week of December?
First week, December 6th, it'll be in the bookstores.
Okay, and it'll be available. So right now you can order it. It won't actually show up until the middle of December, but there you go. So I'd like to thank you, Mac Maloney, for coming on the show. I appreciate your time and all the work you did in putting this book together. I think it's a brilliant book.
Well, thanks a lot. And you know, like I said before, I want to thank you guys because, you know, I'm a writer. I'm a reporter. I report, you know, the research that I've gone over. But it's really people like you who keep this, the idea and the research of this puzzle alive. And I say this in the book, and I mean it. I said, when this is finally solved, when we finally know what UFOs are, it's going to be because of you guys that you'll be the heroes in this, all of the UFO researchers for keeping this idea alive. And I think when we solve it, it's going to be one of the greatest discoveries of the human race, and a lot of it will be because of people like you who made it their life's work to look into this puzzle. And I think everyone will owe you a debt of gratitude when it's finally solved.
Well, I hope it happens in my lifetime.
Me too.
Yeah, me too. Okay, thanks, guys, for tuning in, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.